The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, the fix is in, I fear, but I'll let you have your moment. The clubhouse leader for J1 goal of the season is...
It is Kyogo Furuhashi. I only had to make about 5 or 6 different Twitter accounts to get that poll number up. But yeah, he has won. He's just edged out Marohashi 57% to 43%. So yeah, clubhouse leader is Kyogo Furuhashi.
Fair enough then. All right, well, yeah, the people have spoken. They're allowed to be wrong, and and that's that. So, yeah, well, no doubting the quality of both of the goals, and yet Furuhashi seemed to, tickle a few more people's fancy, so I certainly understand that, and he was in very good form over the weekend, as well as we will get to later on with Alan Gibson when we talk about a perfect Saturday evening for the three Kansai clubs. But first, our major source of J-League news and information during the hiatus was also a witness to pigs flying and hell freezing over on Saturday night at Ajinomoto Stadium as FC Tokyo finally snapped their Urawa hoodoo. Dan Ulowitz, welcome back to the pod. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to be back. And yes, I would not have believed that it happened if I did not see it with my own eyes. Tokyo beat Urawa in a game that mattered, in a J-League game, first time since 2013. First time at Ajinomoto, I believe, in 14 years, if I remember some stat that I saw correctly, because the 2013 game, that was at the old National Stadium.
Yeah, amazing stuff. Just one of those things that Tokyo were never able to get over. They've obviously come close many, many times, numerous draws both at Ajistar and at Saitama as well, and there's obviously been the odd battering here and there that Tokyo have taken at the hands of Reds. But yes, listeners, we're beginning with FC Tokyo again, so the capital city bias is it well and truly alive here on J-Talk. But I mean, this was arguably the match of the round. The teams are coming in at one of the two top six matchups on the slate, and we expect fireworks when these two teams meet. It was a momentous occasion in more than one respect for Tokyo, not just the result. They also farewelled midfielder Kento Hashimoto, who had been with the club in some capacity or another since joining the academy when he was 10 years old. He's heading off to FC Rostov in Russia, and there were also a couple of milestones for defenders of FC Tokyo. Masato Morishige played his 350th J1 game, and Sei Muroya played his 100th in the top flight for FC Tokyo. So there are plenty of milestones for Tokyo, and not counting the one obviously at the end of the 90 minutes. Sam, what did you make of the early exchanges here? It was obviously goalless until just before half time. It seemed fairly even to me, but again, that's me looking through it through red and blue glasses. How did you think the early exchanges panned out?
Yeah, I agree. I think it was kind of a feeling out process. I don't think either team really created too much, and neither team was under too much pressure the other end either. I think Reds they haven't played too... They got the results in the last few weeks, but I wouldn't have said they've played too well, and they are chopping and changing their side, and they leave kind of the flair players out, like Leonardo was on the bench again, so was Sekine. Kashiwagi not in the squad. So you've got, they play a kind of more regimented style with like Nagasawa and Yuruki just working hard more than anything else. And I think their aim is just to kind of keep things tight for as long as possible and then go and bring on these players second half and get the winner that way. But like Tokyo were more than happy to play a fairly cagey game as well, because likewise, Tokyo have got a lot of dangers that can come off the bench or just on a counter-attack when the opposition come forward at them. So I think as you say, quite even game. And I think at that point, both teams are probably kind of content with how it was going.
Yeah, fair enough. So, Dan, how did you think Tokyo handled the early exchanges? Obviously, Shuto Abe has been handed the keys to the car pretty much in a couple of games so far. He's been thrown in at the deep end, obviously, with Yojiro Takahagi enduring a horrid evening a few games ago against Kawasaki. Kenta Hasegawa seems a little bit more comfortable with... putting Abe in. We're going to talk about a question from Thomas Pennington later on about a couple of the other Tokyo youngsters. But yeah, how did you think Abe in particular handled this spotlight?
I thought he did pretty well. I think that Abe certainly is lucky to have played so far, you know, with Hashimoto, with, you know, like having the, for the most part, talented Tokyo, you know, central midfielders, you know, like Hashimoto, like Takahagi, when he is on his game, around. That's a good influence. I thought he did well against Urawa. I think that Urawa came out of the gates somewhat slow. Kenta Hasegawa said after the match that he sort of wished that Tokyo had gone in faster. Instead, they sort of slowed down to match Urawa, and that's why they took so long to get going. I think that Urawa, you know, that they had possession. I believe I said it midway through the second half, and it was already 2-0, and Urawa just looked like they had no chance of coming back. And I think the zone statistic bug said possession was about 50-50, and they both had the same number of shots. And it just sort of goes to show you that stats are meaningless. And it shows you that Tokyo really did, you know, they managed to neutralize all the threats and didn't really give Urawa that much of a chance, even when they did have the ball.
Indeed, yeah. So there were a couple of chances around the 20-minute mark for Ryoya Ogawa first for Tokyo, and then Kenyu Sugimoto for Reds. But yeah, it looked like it was going to be goalless heading into half time before Tokyo went ahead in somewhat fortunate circumstances in the 45th minute. The two milestone boys, Morishige and Maroya, combined. Morishige pinged the ball out to Maroya on the right. He worked a yard of space for a cross, whipped the ball over, and yeah, fortuitously for Tokyo, the ball evaded a dive from Shusaku Nishikawa and a defensive clearing header attempt from Daiki Hashioka, and the ball basically cannoned off Diego Oliveira's chest and dribbled over the line. He's obviously scored some spectacular goals for Tokyo in his time at the club, Diego, but yeah, he didn't really know much at all about the goal that put Tokyo ahead heading into the break. But, Dan, as Tokyo supporters, we'll certainly take it.
We'll take it, absolutely. I looking at the initial goal and then looking at the replay, I almost thought that it might have come off of his shoulder or his forearm. So he was a bit lucky with where the ball landed, but just a great cross from Maroya. The Urawa defender, I don't remember exactly who it was defending there, but that play did remind me of speaking of Urawa players who were sort of left out of the squad, I think Thomas Deng, if he was in the squad, I'm not quite sure if that first goal gets through. I think that he might have done a better job of covering that cross. He's got a bit more height, a bit more athleticism. I think that he could have beaten Diego out. But, of course, you know, what happened, and it was very good timing for Tokyo. Because it is, especially against a team that you've struggled so hard to and so long to win against, you know, going into halftime with the lead and with the other team demoralized, I mean, that's as good as it gets, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Tokyo, yeah, somewhat fortunate, but as we said, we'll take it. And Diego Oliveira gave the Gatsmen the lead going into half time. Well, if there was any fortune about the first goal, there wasn't really any at all about the second, was there, Sam? It was the Adailton Show. He had come off the bench on the just past the hour mark, and then 5 minutes later, in the 66th minute, he caught a dawdling Takuya Aoki on the ball in the centre circle. A poor touch from Aoki, and from there, Adailton didn't really need any further invitation, did he? He just surged forward and, fended off a meek challenge from Takuya Iwanami as Mauricio tried to get across to cover, and, clipped a smart finish back across Nishikawa. So we know Adailton's got this sort of thing in his locker. He wasn't really able to show it on a consistent basis for Jubilo Iwata, but Tokyo supporters are hoping that that's a sign of things to come this season from him.
Yeah, it's goals like this which are really frustrating for people that watch Adailton long term, because He does this time and time again. He did for Jubilo, and he has done a couple of times now for Tokyo. It's a really, really good solo goal. It just took on maybe four or five defenders, and then the composure for the finish was superb. But there are games when he can produce this, and then there are games that he just goes missing. And like throughout his time in Japan, he's not had the consistency. And so now he's got this move to Tokyo. There's going to be more pressure on him here than there would be at Jubilo. But it looks, at the moment, he's had more good performances than poor performances. And I think it helps that he plays alongside the likes of Diego Oliveira and Leandro and Nagai, who's now come back. And they will push him on to be a bit more consistent. So, and if he can produce these types of goals on a regular basis, then Tokyo are a really potent front line. And, but yeah, you can't take anything away from this goal. A really good finish, terrific run, and yeah, Tokyo were deserving at this stage of the 2-0 lead.
So by this stage, Reds had brought on the cavalry, or what they had on the bench to that would constitute a cavalry, with Takahiro Sekine coming on at half-time, then Leonardo and Martinez entering the fray shortly before Adailton replaced Kensuke Nagai. So, Sam, I'll come back to you quickly. Were you disappointed in what Reds were able to muster in the second half? Obviously, as Dan said, they would have been stung by going behind right on the stroke of half-time. But, with literally 45 minutes to claw their way back into the game, offend any Reds supporters listening, but there didn't seem to be an awful lot of cut and thrust about their attempts to get back into it in the second half.
No, it was a really disappointing response from them. Well, it was a lack of response, really. They put a few players up, but they don't have the creativity in midfield when they play Aoki and Shibata. They're good defensive midfielders, but they're not going to really get on the ball and start spreading the play out. And there wasn't really that much of a creativity out to those players like Sekine, like Leonardo, but they didn't really do anything themselves either. And it helped, even though they've got the victories in the last few weeks, a few games, they haven't really looked like a great team. Like, there are good players there, obviously, Leonardo, but maybe his link-up play with Kuroki needs some work, which I'm sure will come with time. But, yeah, it doesn't look like they've kind of sorted out that front four and exactly how they want to play and how they want to link up. It's just been the shift in focus, really, from the manager has been to a more workman-like team and not really an expressive team. And it's difficult for them to click out of that from the mindset of being defensive and regimented into having to score goals and having to create things. And they haven't really got that balance right, I don't think.
Indeed, indeed. All right, well, we mentioned Ashuto Abe before. He almost put the icing on the cake in the 76th minute, but he failed to hit the target after a determined run from inside his own half, and then he took a return pass inside the box, but yeah, screwed wide. So, Dan, well, yeah, it's obviously a very satisfying victory for Tokyo, as you said off the top. They haven't beaten Reds in the league for almost 7 years, so that's a huge monkey off their back, and they'll be very happy to take these 3 points. So, I don't know, what have you made of the season so far through 5 games? Is that Kawasaki result just looking like a total anomaly now? I mean, they've won the other 4 games, so I guess that's a pretty logical conclusion to come to. But, I mean, it's difficult to throw that game out because it was so abhorrent. The first half was just absolutely woeful, and you hate to think they will, you know, might reproduce a performance like that again this year, but, you know, you never know with Tokyo. But, yeah, I mean, the other 4 games have obviously been all 4 wins, and, you know, coming off a win away at Yokohama F Marinos and then doubling up by beating Urawa is a very, very satisfying couple of weeks.
I think that, on paper, and this is something that we say every year as Tokyo fans, on paper, this is a very, 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 very good team. Even without Hashimoto, it's a very good team. I think that arguably one of the strongest attacking trios in the league in Adailton, Diego Oliveira, and Leandro. And, you know, a solid defense, good goalkeeper, you know, Hasegawa is a smart manager. I think all the pieces are there. The question is, are they going to come together? I'll be interested to see how they do when they have to play. I think because of the ACL scheduling, they're going to have a stretch of about 8 to 10 weeks where they're playing a game every other day. And that's going to test the team. So, you know, much like last year with the 8 straight away games, I mean, there's so many external factors that whether or not Tokyo is a good team almost isn't relevant. It's a question of whether they manage to get it done somehow. It's like I've said, it's hashtag Chaos Energy J League. This is going to be a weird one.
Well, yeah, nothing says Chaos Energy J League more than FC Tokyo beating Urawa in a league match. So, absolutely spot on there. I did want to touch on Thomas Pennington's question, Dancer. I'll throw that straight back to you because he wanted to get our thoughts on Hotaka Nakamura, the side back who's played had started the two previous games before coming off the bench for the last 10 minutes here. Sam and I had talked about him a little bit last week. Obviously, he struggled mightily against Kawasaki, but redeemed himself somewhat with a more composed performance against Yokohama F. Marino. So, he was held back from the start here and replaced Ryoya Ogawa for basically the last 10 minutes. He had a little bit of a running battle in that time with Martinez, who was particularly fired up as the match wound down, and Nakamura actually found himself booked 5 minutes after coming on. But, in an admittedly limited sample size, what have you made of him so far?
I think that he's doing okay. I mean, I also think that Martinez was, he fell a bit easily on Saturday on a couple of occasions, and I think that Nakamura, when he's facing that sort of situation, I think how you play as a defender, that's going to tie a lot into whether or not you're getting booked. And whether or not the opposition thinks that they can sort of get away with a bit of an easy fall. We'll have to see. I think that Ogawa, I don't know. I now that I think of it, really, it's always been a bit hard to visualize Tokyo's left back. I think the right back, that Miroya has established himself so well at the position after Tokunaga left, that it's that sort of set, and it's sort of he's 19. I think he's got potential. I think he's got a good career ahead of him, and I think that the experience that he had last year with the J3 will do him well. These kids, and as we know, FC Tokyo is great at raising academy players who go on to really contribute to the top team, and Hashimoto's great proof of this, but they all need time to develop, and they're definitely going to get their shot this year.
Yeah, most definitely. And another player, Kazuya Konno, came on for basically the closing stages of this game, and he's somebody that Alex Bishop had mentioned during the hiatus, I think, that he was looking forward to seeing more of this season. So, with the schedule so congested, Konno is likely to get a decent number of opportunities as well. Okay, so before we let Dan go, Sam, I just wanted to get your thoughts in particular about how big you think the loss of Kento Hashimoto will be for FC Tokyo and how they go about replacing him. Obviously, he's not everybody's cup of tea in the centre of midfield, and I mean, a lot of the stuff he does tends to go unnoticed, I suppose, but he had worked his way into Hajime Moriyasu's national team plans by the time basically all football shut down. So, I don't think he walks into the next Japan starting 11, but he's definitely would be in with a shout of at least making the squad, and that's progress for him at least in the past couple of seasons. Now, what do you think Kenta Hasegawa does with replacing him? Obviously, Takahagi's had his struggles already this season. Whether his legs are starting to go is up for debate, whether he actually had any sort of legs to begin with is also up for debate. I mean, his positioning has often been his saving grace. Whether Arthur Silva, who has been with the club for a couple of years now, is finally ready to take more responsibility. If he's any good, we don't really know that yet. Or otherwise, it looks like it's going to be Shuto Abe and Keigo Higashi. Heaven help us indeed if Higashi's going to have a regular central midfield role. So, I mean, what do you think he does, and how big the loss of Hashimoto will be for FC Tokyo?
I think it's a really big loss. I think, especially the last 2 years, I think he's really developed as a player. He's very intelligent in that midfield. And as you said, a lot of his work goes unnoticed, but he's always in the right position. He's the one that will break up play, but then are equally quite comfortable in starting possession. And I think just if you're going to have to drop Takahagi back into that position, I don't think he quite has the discipline and, as you said, the legs to kind of cover that role. And really, Tokyo's central midfield options are quite limited, because if you're playing both Abe and Higashi in the same midfield, I think it's quite lightweight. I think Tokyo would be bullied fairly often in that midfield. So I'd be looking at bringing in a replacement. You'd have to assume that there'd be a bit of money that's come in from Rostov. I know Japanese teams are not the greatest at selling their assets on to get any sort of transfer funds in that way. But I've not seen Arthur, from what I've seen of Arthur Silva, besides that wonder goal against Kobe, I've not seen him really do a great deal and convince me that he is a first choice holding midfielder in a J-League team. I think he's a little bit kind of lacking positional awareness, I'd say. I think technically he's a really good player, and I think there are good attributes to his game, but I wouldn't necessarily trust him as my starter. So I wonder if there is anyone that is out there that Tokyo have their eye on to bring in this transfer window. I would hope for their sake they do, especially as we've mentioned before, the fixture schedule as well, to have just would it be Takahashi, Abe, Mita, I suppose, and Higashi and Arthur Silva. They're going to have to play a lot of games, a lot of running in that midfield, and I don't think there are enough options to start with. And without Hishimoto, I don't think there's quite enough quality, especially if Tokyo want to be challenging for league titles or for the Champions League or whatnot.
Yeah, and Dan, do you see the loss of Hishimoto being as significant as the loss of Takefusa Kubo was last season? Obviously, Tokyo really struggled creatively after Kubo left. I mean, they're completely different players in different positions, obviously, but we notice almost night and day. It was like flicking a switch on and off when Kubo, obviously, scored two goals in his last game before he left. And then after that, there was, the rest of them were left to try and pick up the pieces creatively. So, Hishimoto leaves a different sort of hole, I suppose. But do you have similar concerns to Sam? And I admit I do myself about, the rest of the squad looks really good and there's a lot of options in attack and the defence looks quite settled and, obviously very well established, the four across the back as well as the keeper Hayashi. Yeah, I do have worries myself about the central midfield, and I don't know if you share those as well.
I think that especially in Japan, it's easier to fill, to find a replacement for central midfield, or at least a competent central midfielder, than it is for some other roles. Yeah, I think you've got, Takahagi will manage. You'll have Mita in the mix. You'll have these young players coming up. I don't rate Arthur Silva either. So, maybe they'll have to go hunting and find a bargain, in the coming transfer window. Especially with the schedule coming up, which is just, you look at it and it's absolutely ridiculous. But I don't think it's the biggest thing after Kubo left was that Diego Oliveira just didn't have a playmaker to set him up. He didn't have that spark plug, and he looked lost. Him and Nagai both looked kind of lost after Kubo left, and now they don't have this problem. Because you look at how the three Brazilians and Nagai feed off each other and create these plays, and Moroya is setting them up. And so I think that they'll be fine, or I should say not as dire as they were after Kubo left. It'll be an adjustment. I don't think that the light's gone off. I just think it's gotten a little dimmer.
Yeah, fair enough then. All right, well, so FC Tokyo 2, Urawa 0 at Ajinomoto Stadium on Saturday night. But Sam, while we've got Dan here, I know there's a couple of other things you wanted to raise with him before we let him go.
Yeah, there were a couple of kind of newsworthy items that came out over the weekend and today. The first one, that came out, I think it was like Friday night here, Saturday morning in Japan, but there is concerns that CFG are pulling out of Yokohama F. Marinos. I know that you said earlier in the green room that there are kind of differing opinions on what's happening there, but what is the latest that you know, Dan?
It seems to be that some outlets have reported that City are sort of ending their ties with Nissan because they had that partnership, which sort of was a part of the deal to purchase about 20% of Marinos. And so as part of ending that partnership, they're possibly looking to sell their shares in the club. The president of Marinos has, Kurosawa, has denied those reports, and he's saying that they're working on extending their contract and renewing it. And I think that it is a very tempestuous time for everyone, especially if you're running football empires spanning the globe and have millions of dollars and billions of dollars really tied up in all of those, and then you've got a global pandemic to deal with. So I think that it's going to take a little while to sort out. I don't quite know what the full situation is, but it would absolutely be a loss for Marinos if they were to leave City Football Group. I think that it's given them exposure, it's given them access to not just an expanded scouting pool, but all the analytics that they're running and all the data tracking and all the stuff that has allowed Ange to create the team that he's tried to create. And so without that, I don't think that they're a bad team, even though they're struggling, but they won't be as good as they were as a part of the, you know, the City family, so to speak.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see kind of what happens there and how that affects Marinos in the long run. But for the league as a whole, we've obviously had the 5,000 fans have come into the stadium for the last couple of games. And then I understand there was a meeting earlier on today to discuss whether the 5,000 would have to be extended. So what's been decided today?
Today they decided that they're going to extend that. It was originally supposed to be 5,000 through the end of this month, and then from August 1st they would possibly be able to go as far as 50% of stadium capacity. So Ajinomoto could hold about 25,000, Saitama could hold about 30,000, Nissan Stadium about 36,000, but they've decided to keep the 5,000 limit through August 10th, and then they're going to basically look at the schedule in 2-week increments and decide whether or not those matches can be held and under what circumstances they can hold them in terms of venue capacity and ticket sales and all that. And it's a very fluid situation because today, Monday, there were about a little under 170 cases in Tokyo. 170, I think that's right. It's honestly, it's all blended together. It's all just numbers of me. Yeah, 168 cases today, and you know, we had 188 yesterday. I think the 3 days before it was close to 300. It's a Monday, so you know, testing the test results are always sort of low on Mondays. We have no idea what's going to happen. But the next important dates are that the government's medical panel will give their recommendations on Wednesday, and then next Monday the J-League NPB task force will meet, and then the J-League's executive committee will meet again, and they're going to figure out what's going to happen after August 11th. So I guess from then till mid-August, or I should say late August, the 24th or 25th, you know, we'll know what's going on then.
Has there been any indication that they might open up certain areas of the country? So say in Kyushu, they might be able to have the 50% of the stadiums, while in Tokyo it's retained at 5,000, or are they planning on doing it blanket across the league?
They do have the option to do that. The current guidelines do give the league flexibility to work with clubs and to work club by club and figure out what solution is best for each club and for each stadium. I did ask Chairman Murai about that today, and he said that essentially, given the circumstances, the rise in cases, not just in Tokyo, but also in some other prefectures, And given that the public is a bit concerned about having these large-scale events, because so far, even though there have been no reported cases of the coronavirus that have happened at a J-League game, no fans are infected, no players or team staff have been infected since early June, that's still 5,000 people. That's a lot. And even socially distanced, as we've seen these last couple of rounds, that's a lot. And I don't think that the public has the appetite for 30,000 people going to Saitama, all sharing that train back, because you can't socially distance, you can't physically distance on on that train coming back from Saitama Stadium. Or, the train coming back from Ajinomoto or from Nissan or from anywhere, really. So even if you're sitting apart in the stadium, there's a risk there. And I think that the decision today was a smart thing to do. 5,000, no away fans, no beer sales in the stadiums. And this is the new normal.
All right, Dan. Well, thanks very much for that update, Dan. Firstly, on CFG and Yokohama F. Marinos, and yes, on the online news conference from Mitsuru Murai today. Dan has an excellent piece already up on the Japan Times website that we encourage you to check out. Unless, of course, you've reached your monthly limit for free articles, you're allowed to check out on the Japan Times website, in which case you should obviously subscribe to said publication. Anyway, Dan, it's been terrific to catch up with you again, and all the best. We didn't actually ask you about the atmosphere inside the ground, because you've obviously been going the past couple of weeks, but obviously you've got a couple of weeks worth of experience, whereas we asked Neil and Stuart Woodward last week from the fans' perspective. I guess you've probably kind of gotten used to it now after 3 weeks.
No, you don't get used to it. This is all weird. This is all, like, I mean, this was my fourth game since everything restarted. That sound, wait. This was round five, mm-hmm. I think.
Yes.
So I've been to, I saw the Verdy Machida game, Urawa, with that amazing display with the cards and everything, the Tamagawa Classico, Kawasaki, Kashiwa, and then this game. So I guess I've been to five. That sounds about right. Mm-hmm. So it's all weird. I think that I almost want to say that the clapping, the applause during the game on Saturday was a bit louder than it was at the Frontale Reysol game. That could be the acoustics of Ajinomoto, or it could just be that the fans have adjusted to it and they sort of know that they're supposed to clap for good plays. And it's interesting. It's almost, it's like a tennis match.
I was going to say, do you feel like you're at a Broadway play? Like a famous actor comes on stage and everybody claps. And then, yeah.
But everyone screams when if they're really famous. And as a fan of Broadway and a fan of musicals in general, yeah, it's much louder. It's probably much louder in theater than it was at that stadium, depending on which show you're seeing. But it's weird. You get a sense of how well the fans understand the game. It's not like when they can sing and they're just singing the same song over and over again, or they're sort of cheering. Yeah, they're trying to encourage the players. It's actually they're actually responding to what's happening on the pitch. And so if there's a good defensive play, they'll clap. And if there's a good cross, they'll clap, even if the next shot misses. And it's been interesting to watch that, and it certainly feels more comfortable than it did for those two closed door games, or I should say those three closed door remote matches that I saw. it's all weird. I don't know. I mean, I guess this is, well, it's better than nothing, I guess. I'm not gonna say, like, well, no, this is football without fans is nothing, because it's, you know, any, even that scoreless new Tokyo Derby was still better than nothing. But, yeah, it was good to be back in Ajinomoto and to be back to see a crowd and to see Hashimoto get a send-off, because it would have been disappointing if he'd been able to do that behind, you know, closed doors. So it was good for him, and, yeah, this is, you know, this is what it is for a little while, for varying degrees of little while.
Yes, indeed. All right, well, yeah, as I said, terrific to get your thoughts on, yeah, Tokyo's win over Urawa and everything else that's going on news-wise. So thanks again, Dan, and, yeah, we'll speak to you again soon, I hope.
Thanks, guys, anytime.
All right, then, after a quick hit of music, Sam and I will be joined by Alan Gibson. Don't worry, Kawasaki supporters, we will get to you and your big victory over Yokohama FC later as you continue to top the table. But joining us next to wrap up a fantastic weekend for the three Kansai clubs is Alan Gibson. Alan, welcome back to the pod. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you very much, and really happy and really busy that J-League is back. So good to speak to you guys.
Absolutely brilliant. Great to have you on again, Alan. And, well, yeah, we'll get to the game that you were actually at on Saturday, a Vissel Kobe beating Shimizu S-Balls, actually last in our wrap of the three Kansai clubs, if you don't mind. We'll begin with Cerezo Osaka, who are, pretty much the closest challengers to Kawasaki at the top of the table. They're a level on points with FC Tokyo in second spot after a 2-1 away victory over Sanfrecce Hiroshima. And, Cerezo have done exceptionally well to start the season, Alan. It's four wins from five. Their customary sturdy defence, but they had a few incidents here. In particular, Mata Jonic didn't have his best game. But, ultimately, they've been doing just enough to get by, and you've seen them a number of times this season. So how have you assessed them so far before we really dig into it to Saturday night's game?
I think before Saturday night's game, there was the debacle, shall we call it, against Nagoya. Two games back now, which was probably the worst game I've seen Cerezo play in quite a while, where Mata Jonic actually scored an own goal, and then the second goal was a very average one too. It was very unusual, Cerezo, because as we saw last season, the best defence in the league, Mata Jonic and Kim in goal are excellent players and deserve more recognition. And then I saw them at the start of the season, which of course is way back in late February now, where they ironed out a 1-0 win over Oita Trinidad to take up where they left off last season, basically. Then I saw them at Gamba, where they won 2-1 and did obviously enough. Excellent goal from Marahashi in particular. Then they took out S-Pulse. I saw that again. I've been lucky. So that's three games that I've seen at Cerezo this year. And it was interesting because S-Pulse were and are, as I'm sure others have discussed, playing this Marinos-esque passing and slightly risky football and playing from the back. And at the moment, they're not doing very well at it. In this game, they took the game to they took the game to Cerezo quite often. But Cerezo just soaked it up and then just hit them, you know, just got their two goals. And then I thought, yep, they're definitely going for the championship again this year. I was like very close to the top. And then they sank without trace against Nagoya. So it was interesting to see them come back against Sanfrecce team and take an away win. It'll be interesting to see what they come up with as I talk the day after tomorrow against Vissel Kobe.
Yes, most definitely. All right, so yeah, they travelled down to Hiroshima on Saturday night and took a 20th minute lead through a Sho Sasaki own goal, actually, after a amazing dribble down the right from Tatsuhiro Sakamoto. He crossed and Sasaki basically sliced the ball into his own net under pressure from Ken Tokura, who might have cheekily tried to claim the goal at first, but ultimately, yeah, it was awarded as an own goal. So, Alan, Sakamoto, I must admit to knowing not a great deal about him. We know that Cerezo brought through a number of really good young players in the past decade or so. I know he's not a homegrown player. Actually, he began in the FC Tokyo system. But, at least on this occasion, he was very impressive and helped to set up the first goal. What do you know about Sakamoto?
I think he's done very well. I was pretty much in a similar position to you. There's a lot of good players coming through at Cerezo. In fact, in my area, for want of a better word, at Gamba and Vissel, there's a lot of young players coming through at all of these teams. And in particular, I think Gamba and Cerezo have had the benefit of the under-23 teams to help them develop players. And they've both used it very well. And at the start of this season, as I said, I've seen them three times and I'm going to see them again on Wednesday night. I was thinking, this number 17 on the right wing, who is that? And I had to look him up in the first game that I saw him. And he's not scared to take players on, is he? He's a very good young player. He reminded me a bit of Furuhashi at one point, I was thinking, because he seemed to be stuck in a team that was pragmatic and really trying to play defensively, and this guy was the only one trying to break out of it. And that's a bit like Vissel Kobe had been doing for the first few games of the season. They seem to be holding back the player that wants to do the running. And this Sakamoto looks very good. I just hope he'll be able to blossom among all the other defensive stuff that Lottina really, really practices. Because, he looks quite exciting.
Yeah, most definitely. Sam, did you know much about Sakamoto before this this measly dribble on Saturday night?
Yeah, well, he played at Montedio Yamagata last season in J2 as they kind of pushed into the playoffs, and Charlie Houghton obviously was a big fan of him there. He came on, especially the last 2 or 3 months there, putting in a lot of good performances, and I've been equally impressed with him at Cerezo. I think he's definitely got that drive to go and create something, to run at defenders, and I think he adds a little bit of something different to the Cerezo attack, which occasionally could be a little bit one-paced and a bit mundane, but yeah, he's a bit of an X-factor there, and I do agree with the Furuhashi kind of, what's the word?
Comparison,
that's the one. really impressed with him. He did well to create the goal, and I thought he continued in the second half. He had a header off the crossbar. Yeah, and really lively. Very impressed with him.
All right then. So, Cerezo held the lead until half-time, and then this game really sprung to life 5 minutes into the second half when Naoyuki Fujita won the ball back 35 yards from goal and then took a return pass from Hiroshi Kiyotake before sliding a smart finish under Takato Hayashi. I should mention Kiyotake had hit the bar with a free kick 9 minutes before half-time, before he set up Fujita for Cerezo's second goal. But Cerezo didn't really have much breathing space for too long, because basically straight from the restarts, Sanfrecce attacked and Douglas Vieira was upended on the edge of the box by Mate Jonic, and the referee pointed to the spot. The Brazilian firing home from 12 yards past Kim Jin-hyun. So, Alan, they might have been tempted to relax a little bit, and maybe they had done once they went 2-0 up, but Sanfrecce pegged them back pretty much straight away after that.
Yeah, it was a good game then, a bit sort of end-to-end and chess-like, if you like. It was interesting that Cerezo, just like they did against Gamba, they went 2-1 and they conceded a penalty kick. I think that's half of their goals. 2 out of 4 that they've conceded have been penalties, and the other two were those terrible ones against Nagoya, which was obviously an off day. So if we sort of take the big picture, it looks like Cerezo Osaka's defense is doing its job, and it's going to be a tough season and a season of 1-0 wins for them, I think. I'm quite looking forward to it.
All right, and then Kim Jin-hyun stood strong in the Cerezo goal in the closing stages with a number of smart saves to preserve the 3 points for the visitors. So, Sam, obviously we've mentioned them numerous times during the latter stage of the hiatus, wondering, which clubs might benefit from, this congested schedule And with the games coming so quickly on top of each other, Cerezo, the way they go about things, they might have been suited to that. So I guess we said with Dan, with kind of, you have to throw the Kawasaki result out as an anomaly for FC Tokyo. And in time, we might have to do the same thing with, as Alan said, that Nagoya result for Cerezo, because apart from that game, they have a spotless record, as Tokyo do without that Kawasaki loss.
Yeah, that Nagoya game, it turned on one moment where Kim and Jonic had their first breakdown in communication in a couple of years, so it doesn't happen very often. And then they played against a Nagoya team that are happy to defend, and they scored a very good goal to get 2-0, so I wouldn't necessarily say, oh, panic stations after that game. And I thought defensively they were a little bit better in this game. Still not perfect. As you mentioned at the start, Jonic didn't quite have his best game, but there are so many good defenders just in that back line. And then the way they set up, it is, I think, perfectly suited to playing multiple games in a week, because you don't have to necessarily expend the energy when everyone knows the positions they're in. However, I was saying, very similar to Sanfrecce Hiroshima a couple of podcasts back, and they've gone on to have a horrible run since, so I don't really want to jinx Cerezo by going too overboard on them.
No, fair enough then. All right, well, yes, the other half of Osaka also enjoyed a fruitful Saturday night and also won their match 2-1. It was a Gunma Osaka hosting Oita at the Panasonic Stadium Suita. But unlike Cerezo, Gunma had to come from behind after an excellent header from Daiki Watari in the 33rd minute gave Oita the lead. But their advantage lasted just 4 minutes as Takashi Usami equalised from the penalty spot. And then Adam Milson grabbed the winner for Gunma 3 minutes into the second half after excellent work from Usami to win the ball back. Out on the right, he fed Admilson, and the Brazilian did the rest. So, a very satisfying evening for Gunma as well, Alan, especially as they had to come from behind, as I mentioned.
I'm trying not to say people like to come from behind, so I'll stay out of that one, shall I? Gunma, well, I thought they were... I was watching Vissel over the top of the screen of my telephone as I watched Gunma at the same time. So it was quite interesting, and I was, you know, up and down. And, I must say that Usami's tackle reminded me of someone, and it was me.
Okay.
It's really funny, because I thought, wow, I slide in and grab the ball. I don't necessarily do anything with it like Usami did, but the amount of times I strip the ball off players like that because I like sliding. And it was very unusual to see a forward do that, wasn't it? And Usami grabbed the ball and just got up immediately and slipped it into Adam Milson, who did the rest. So it was an excellent move. But I was watching, at one point I started counting the Gunma passes, because they really were completely dictating the game, as they've often done, well, possibly since like 2005 with Nishino, when I've been watching them. They don't necessarily do something with the ball so often. But, I mean, at one point, it was Gunma were, like, literally passing the ball 28 or 30 times before a guy from Oita managed to kick it. And Gunma pushed it, forced it, and grabbed it back again and passed the ball around for another 25 or 30 times before they finally took a shot. And it was quite incredible to see the way they just dictated the pace of the game. But the key point was that they could make that final killer pass when they wanted to. And they just looked very, very nicely drilled by Miyamoto as a manager, of course. So I really enjoyed the Gunma game, even though I was supposed to be watching Vissel.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, well, Sam, Tomoki Iwata, who we mentioned a couple of times in the last season and a bit, obviously he has impressed in his time at Oita. Well, he was the man who conceded the penalty when he tripped Kosuke Onose, and then he almost scored an own goal, which would have been 100% the fault of the Oita goalkeeper Shun Takagi in the 56th minute. I mean, as a Liverpool supporter, this almost reminded me of a Simon Mignolet cock-up or two from the last couple of seasons. But how could you describe this incident to our listeners? I think if we had goal line technology, I'm pretty certain that the referee's watch would have been buzzing after that.
It's a very good question, but I have to be honest, I don't remember it. So I don't want to sound like, I don't know, I just didn't see it. I don't,
This was the one where Iwata passed the back and the keeper just let it go across him, right?
Yeah.
And then he let it go across him, but then he realised he was the ball was about to cross the line. And I watched the replay and the ball literally did cross the line. At least 4/5 of that ball was over, but it wasn't a goal. I mean, it wasn't in, but it was a very risky play. And if Adam Milson, it was Adam Milson there, I think. If Adam Milson actually sort of lunged in or slid a little bit, he might have got a touch and got the goal there. But certainly would have been Iwata's fault, I think.
You reckon? Oh, okay. Well,
Wouldn't have been.
No, I don't think. I can. Yeah, 100% agree. Yeah, Takagi. Yeah, he just had an absolute brain fart there, which is unfortunate. But well, I guess he got away with it at the end of the day. But yeah, his side left empty-handed, as we said, Gumba claiming all 3 points, and decent enough value for it, as well as they climbed up to 5th in the table. So good times rolling for Gumba. And interestingly enough, though, Alan, we have not seen Gen Shoji in a Gumba Osaka match day squad yet. I think there was talk that he might have been right to go after the hiatus, but that has obviously not been the case, as we haven't seen any side of him at all yet. So do you know any of the inside goss about when Shoji might be available to feature for Gumba?
I do. He was actually ready after the hiatus. Well, put it this way, if Gamba were playing only one game a week or a standard season, he probably would have played, because he had an ankle injury. It was, 80 to 90% okay, and it's been wrapped and whatever, been taken care of. But Gamba probably wisely decided that since the season is going to be so long and hard, that they'll wait till he's completely fit again. Apparently he is completely fit again now, but I think they've just won their 2 in a row and got a... So perhaps, who knows whether they need another centre-back at the moment.
All right. Well, I presume you think he would improve them. So you want to see him in there sooner rather than later?
Indeed. I mean, to be honest, he's an excellent player. I had Gamba are playing three back sometimes and four back sometimes, and he can fit in either system. In fact, he even played right full back in a four back system at times overseas and even at Antlers, I think. So he's definitely a good addition to the squad, which Gamba haven't even had to use yet. So personally, I like him. I think I've mentioned on the pod before, I've seen him grow up since he was a kid, you know, literally in the Kobe area. So I'm really looking forward to him putting that blue and black shirt on and getting him to sign mine as well.
You had a nice little segue there, Alan, mentioning the three backs or the four backs. We had a question from Johnny Nicol on Patreon, so thank you, Johnny, for the question. But he asked, is three centre-backs or a 4-4-2 the best system? Which one suits Gamba the best?
An interesting question. I shall address it. I think it's literally, I mean, again, going back to Akira Nishino and 2005 or 6-7 or whatever, when actually Miyamoto, the manager of Gamba now, was one of his centre-backs, along with Yamaguchi Satoshi, who is now Miyamoto's assistant, and Sanayoshi, who is now the Kyoto Saga coach. So a little bit of Nishino graduates are taking over the country right now. But I think that Gamba have always been able to adjust quite well, and Miyamoto's got them playing however he wants them to. They've got... Miura, Kim and Takao, who are playing now when they play three backs. Of course, Shoji's in the wings, and Suganuma is also there, who has played a few times, but I don't think he's the best for a three-back system. He's quite hard, and he gets stuck in when there's two centre-backs and two full-backs, but in the three-backs, I much prefer Miura, Kim, Takao, and of course Shoji when he's ready. But I think they started the season against Yokohama F. Marinos with exactly the right idea, which, of course, other teams have now also seen how to pressure and take care of F. Marinos' game. But Gamba did that, where they played three backs and they pushed up the midfield and the two wing backs and really pressured them so they couldn't play. And, of course, they won that game 2-1 and surprised a few. And since then, I think they've played mostly three backs, and I think... So they perhaps played four backs and lost against Cerezo. So did they play four backs then? As I said, Miyamoto can literally have them playing almost anywhere. He's obviously got the respect and the knowledge of the players, the respect of the players, that basically they'll do. And of course, we've seen where they're either losing or winning and want to hold a lead or want to change things, where it's thrown one player on and literally they've gone from three backs to four backs in, you know, while the sub's walking on. So I'm not sure. The question was actually, which one is the best, I think? And in my opinion, I think the best is a three-back system because, in particular, Ornosay on the right is an extremely hard worker and a fantastic player who has really grown since he moved up from J2. And on the left, they have Fujiharu and Yuya Fukuda, who is an excellent player. They've even so happy with their full-backs or wing-backs that they've let OJS go to Nagoya Grampus. So for me, it's three backs for Gamba.
All right. Well, do you echo that thought, Sam? I mean, you obviously see Gamba every week as well, so you might have an opinion on Johnny's question. And I guess if they play three centre backs, then that's just an extra way to shoehorn the Shoji in as well, I suppose, without disrupting the furniture too much.
Yeah, I think I agree with everything Alan said. I think it's kind of been built for Shoji to come in, and you have to be used to the system for when he plays, because you can't drop, I don't think, one of Shoji, Kim or Miura. And it also opens up the mid, because there's so many midfield options at Gamba, so they'd want as many of those in there as possible, and this allows you to get Idiguchi, Yajima and Endo or Kurata, whoever you want in that midfield. And it just seems to be, you can get the strongest team out of it. I agree with when you've moved to full back, it has done a couple of times at half-time, and it's not really worked in games. I think you look a lot more solid in the 3-5-2, and I think it gets the best out of the two front men and the midfield. So I think, yeah, definitely the way to go for me.
Thank you, Johnny Nicol.
Most definitely. All right, and well, speaking of Johnny, we might as well cover the second part of his question as well now, Alan, because, I mean, they doesn't relate to any of the teams we're talking about here, but, yeah, Johnny did specifically address it to you, and it is a refereeing-based question, so let's do it now. Okay, so Johnny mentions that Takuma Arano of Sapporo was shown a straight red card, and Thiago Alves of Tosu was shown a second yellow this past Saturday, and both were sent off for kicking out at opponents, while Kotaro Omori in J2, of Jubilo Iwata, I should say, last week got nothing for the same offence. Johnny asks, should the J-League use retroactive bans to punish players who get away with violent conduct during a game?
May I clear my throat for a long answer? Go. Okay. Firstly, I definitely would like to see players punished for things that the referees do not see. If it is dirty, even goading and verbal, and stuff like spitting, but something that the referee does see. And I think as they brought VAR in, and also when they brought in retroactive video disciplining or whatever they called it back in the Premier League, for example, some of the wording was the fact that if the referee saw it, there would be no more action taken. So even if the VAR people or the video people 10 years ago decided it was a red card offence, if the referee had given a foul, had spoken to the player or had given a yellow card and put it in his match report, there was no more action that could be taken. I'm not sure how flexible they are again now these days, but for example, Omori went down, sort of turned around and flicked a kick out. The referee was very close by, and they obviously saw it. And I guess Johnny, as addressed me as a referee, there's a lot of ways that this can be taken. And I think, for example, Thiago Alves, the game was getting a little out of hand, and I think about a minute before Juan Marin, the goalkeeper of Avispa Fukuoka, had a little set too on the edge of the area, and the referee had to separate them and shout at them. And then literally 30 seconds later, it was up the other end and the game was getting out of control. And then the player was taken down and Omori kicked out, but the referee was right there and he saw it. And credit to the Avispa player who didn't roll around screaming, and none of the players were begging for red cards, which is a big help for me. I think that while I'm going to have very double standards here, because while a kick out like that is a red card offence, I think the referee calmed the game down very well without escalating it with a red card and then throwing. I think he had a little word with Omari very quietly, and you know, even as he ran away. So Omari kicked and even an attempted kick, as we saw actually with Thiago Alves, who didn't really make any contact. And I think it was Yoshida who didn't even go down and probably didn't even feel anything. He thought the referee was about to give him a card for something. I mean, he gave him a yellow. But he looked quite concerned and thought he might be getting a red. And then suddenly the red card came out for Thiago Alves. And in this case, I think it was because that the again, there was something leading up to the game. And Alves was obviously very frustrated. So Thiago Alves, yes, it was a second yellow, probably not a red, which, of course, unfortunately for him, he'd already got a yellow card. Who was the other kick?
Alano in the Sapporo.
Oh, that's right. Oh, yeah, that was just highly frustrating. And yes, it was a red card offence. Again, the referee could have had a very quiet word and tried to calm people down, but yeah, it was a red. So discussing decisions, yeah, it's up to the referee in his discretion. He can calm things down, but the actual question was, do we want to see retrospective action? For me, I would really love to see retrospective action given against players who cheat, for want of a better word, who kick players off the ball, who elbow them and the referee doesn't see it, or even those who will just, you know, spit in someone's face or keep tugging at their, you know, even grabbing them by the balls when the referee doesn't see it. And then the other guy swings around and smacks him and gets a red card. If it's seen that it was provocation, this is the kind of thing that I'd really love to see taken care of at a later date. With no VAR right now, the referee can't be sort of nudged through his earphone and say, I think you missed number seven, they've just kicked out at someone, and have a good look. So, yes, in a nutshell, I would love to see some retroactive stuff given for the right offences. A bit of frustration. Like on Morris, for example, even if the referee doesn't necessarily see it, if the other guy didn't make a meal of it, didn't go down, they get up, they even shake hands or talk about it later, okay, let's get over it. But the guys who, for want of a better word, play like hockey players who provoking and kicking and doing sneaky stuff that is caught on camera, this is the stuff I'd like to see taken care of.
Can I just test your memory, because mine's failing me a little bit.
I
remember maybe 6 years ago, there was the Kim Min-hyuk, I think, where he stamped on an opponent's head. Do you remember if that was a court jerk by the referee, or was that a respective action ban? Because I know he got maybe 6 to 8 games, but was that just them extending the ban afterwards, or was it missed by the referee during the game?
There was that. I believe that one was missed by the referee. Wasn't there a one closer to that with Kanazaki Mu? Also,
yeah,
something rather nasty, but he got a red card for that, didn't he?
Yeah, I think Kanazaki did. I mean, it was just the Tosu player, I don't think, did the one I think. I think it was Kim Min-hyuk.
And I think Kim Min-woo, is that his name? Kim Min-woo was again, a frustrating thing, but a very naughty thing that, yeah, I think you're right that the referee didn't see it, so there may have been retroactive action. Which might have caused a bit of a scene at the time, if I remember correctly, because it wasn't officially on the books. But I guess, you know, these things happen. So certain players, you know, get a red card or after the fact, or an extra game or two ban for kicking a water bottle over on the side in frustration later. I think that's the kind of thing that we don't really need. And as a player myself who gets a bit upset at the referees and will, you know, go off and kick the corner flag or something, I don't want to see that kind of thing being given a red card or retrospective action. You know, it's disrespectful to the corner flag or to the roof. But, you know, I mean, that kind of stuff, I can understand where players are coming from. But if they smack someone else or kick someone else or someone on the bench, yeah, it'd be interesting to see if any retroactive stuff is taken and if it's official. I mean, are they discussing it? Because VAR is not in the works this year, of course, as we know. Yeah, I'd like to see. I'd be surprised and even a little upset if Omari did get some retrospective action. So, is that the right word? Retrospective. So we'll see. I think what's interesting is, if I may digress again, is Hiromi Hara was on the DAZN show, J League Judgment, as they're calling it, discussing various things, most of which are, you know, inconsequential. They usually agree with the referee, and they're not being They're not quite doing the Alan Shearer or Alan Hansen or whoever goes nuts in England, but they're showing certain things, and most of the time they seem to be agreeing with the referee a lot. But what was really irritating me was that Hiromi Hara was saying that Goya, Hiroto Goya of Kashiwa Reysol, goes down easily. Is probably the best translation I could use for it. And I'm really upset that someone at such a high position in the J League on television is passing that kind of judgment and on the reputation of a player. And I think he said at the end of last season too, that a player goes down easily. To me, if it's a foul, it's a foul. If the player goes down easily, it doesn't matter, it's still a foul. The referee can... well, let's talk about Douglas's yellow card, for example. If I may digress. I know we're going to get to this later, I guess, Ben, so sorry to...
Let's move on to the Kobe Shimizu game. So, yeah, Douglas's yellow card in the 20th minute.
Let's segue in too early for that. But Douglas was fouled, I think, three times on the way to going down. Nothing major, and he managed to stand up and shrug off the Huang, I think it was, who was pulling him back. And finally, Huang stuck his, I think he took his left arm around his waist, but didn't really make much contact. And then put his right arm on Douglas's shoulder. And again, didn't really make much contact. And that's when Douglas fell like a pack of cards. Now, for me, Douglas, the irritating thing is that Douglas probably felt he had to overreact to get the penalty. Whereas, in my opinion, these players should not need to overreact. Referees should give that as a penalty kick. Well, I mean, not necessarily a penalty, but it's in the area. But a foul is a foul. You know, if a player grabs a shirt or just, you know, flicks his ear or whatever, and in this case, puts his hand on the shoulder, there is so much foul play in the game that is not given. And then players decide that they must go down to get a free kick, and then they don't get it because they're accused of diving. He didn't dive. I mean, he overreacted completely to a foul, and to be honest, he could have gone down much earlier, but he wanted to get in the area before he went down, perhaps. You know, it swings and roundabouts. Now, to me, Douglas was fouled. It was a penalty kick, but 99% of the people watching that will say it was a dive. So this kind of thing also, retroactively, I'd say perhaps Douglas could lose the yellow card. I don't know. I mean, it's a bit controversial. And it's totally impossible to even suggest that, I guess. But the things, you know, in the end, you have to feel sorry for the referees. And the fact that they don't have VAR might please many, many people, probably including myself in many times. But, you know, in the end, it's down to the referee on the field and... I don't know. So I've led you into to Vissel Kobe there with a long diatribe on referees. So please, let's continue now.
Most definitely. Yes, indeed. So, yeah, Douglas was booked in the 20th minute. But as we'll get to later, he had the last laugh on the evening. But it was, clubhouse leader for goal of the season, Kyogo Furuhashi, who bagged a brace that, spurred Kobe on to their 3-1 home victory over Shimizu. I don't think either of Furuhashi's goals here will be goal of the season contenders, but obviously very valuable ones for Vissel. In first half stoppage time, his glancing header at the near post from Andres Iniesta's corner gave Kobe a half-time lead. The ball somehow evading Togo Umeda's mistimed punch. Then at 9 minutes after the break, Kobe had some proper breathing room after Furuhashi led a break from deep inside the Kobe half, and he played the ball forward, an almost inch-perfect pass for Douglas, who slid in to toe-poke past Umeda and then declined to celebrate against his former team. Yusuke Goto spurned a glorious chance to get Espols back into the game in the 63rd minute, and 2 minutes later, Vissel were out of sight after Douglas's header came back off a post and Furuhashi fired home through traffic and through Umeda's legs. Espols got a consolation with 15 minutes left when Kenta Nishizawa pounced on a blind back pass from Gotoku Sakai and finished in off Hiroki Ikura. But Kobe cruised home and moved up four spots to 8 in the table. So, Kobe will have been disappointed to lose the clean sheet in the last 15 minutes, Alan. But otherwise, a very satisfying Saturday evening at the office for them.
Indeed, no one can complain about three goals, 3 points. Furuhashi scoring a couple more again. It looked at times, I think maybe two or three games back, I think Vissel Kobe were, they literally, I think they just, they don't seem to care about scoring goals, which is obviously, you know, not what we want to be. I mean, they just pass and pass and pass, and Furuhashi was obviously being held back. He'd get the ball on the left wing, and instead of running forward, he'd look for the pass back again. And I think the game against Oita Trinita, where Vissel Kobe completely switched the team, I think all the foreigners were out. Just Douglas was on the bench and came on very late. But it was a bunch of, well, quite a lot of youngsters and players who were playing for their place, perhaps, shall we say, and not the not being influenced perhaps by Iniesta on the field. Perhaps they seemed to be a lot more excited to play against Oita Trinita, where, of course, they only won a 1 point and a 1-1 goal. But I think there were eight or nine of the team, including the subs, the 18 players, were Vissel Kobe graduates and very young. And I think perhaps the team and the manager saw what the youngsters could do, and they sort of released them a little bit, because Ogawa came on and ran around a bit very well. And Furuhashi was noticeably more free with the ball, thank goodness. And Vissel scored, seemed to score three goals quite effortlessly with plenty of opposition. I think Sam will appreciate it and know what I'm talking about, but even in this game where Iniesta played and Douglas was on the field too, but I think there were at least eight, perhaps nine of the Vissel Kobe 18 were young Vissel Kobe graduates. Even someone like Ogawa, for example, who's not a spring chicken anymore, but started at Vissel and went out on loan a couple of times. They've got a bunch of really good players coming in, like Yasui and Goke. I'm trying to think of someone special. Well, I guess even Leo Osaki, who was brought in from Tokushima Vortis and spent two or three years in the lower leagues of America, for want of a better word. These players are being blended into a very good team. And as we saw against Oita Trinita, even without the completely foreign contingent and a lot of young players, Vissel have got what it takes. They just seem to hesitate in getting out of first gear sometimes. Sam, your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. I think you just Kobe needs to find that blend. I think you need a mixture of the good things that happened against Oita, and then you bring in, say, if you have a Vermaelen in the back line, just to kind of help them along at the back, because they can be a bit shaky. They were first half against Oita, so just to have that experience there, and then have Iniesta in midfield. I think if you can then combine the way that Iniesta necessarily wants to play, which is a little bit more like controlled possession, and then if he can kind of mesh up with Furuhashi, which he did a lot last season, where you can release Furuhashi and allow him to go and express himself, and then he and Douglas work really well going forward together. And I like the addition of Ogawa as well, because he adds something a bit different. He's a lot more direct, he's a lot more kind of enthusiastic and going forward, so I think that really helped the dynamic. Although this game, I think it'd be interesting to see how you approach the game against Cerezo, because Shimizu are a side that are trying to play this Marinos-style football and will leave gaps all over the place. And Vissel took full advantage of that in this game, and you won't get those sorts of gaps against Cerezo. So it'll be interesting to see how Vissel look to break them down. I remember last season, I think it was the opening day, where Cerezo just put everyone behind the ball, and Vissel then just passed it in front of them for 90 minutes, and obviously that didn't work. And if they're going to play this slower style, again, I don't think it's going to work against Cerezo. So it is how you can link the two styles of football together and use them at the right time, which will be how Vissel can improve as a team. Because I think against Shimizu and teams like that, they'll get joy, but there are other teams, like you saw against Hiroshima, and I think we might see against Cerezo, where Vissel do struggle to break down an opponent. And at the back, it's still shaky. I know they're improving a little bit. I do like Osaki as a defender, but there is still a way for him to go, and especially when Saka, who you don't expect to make a mistake, is playing in the opposition, then there are still worries at the back for Vissel. But I thought this is, on the whole, a fairly promising performance.
What he said.
So what about Shimizu, Sam, then, before we let Alan go? I mean, obviously, they're, again, we talked about Cerezo as one of the teams that might do well. Their style of football suited to the games coming thick and fast. And Shimizu, we wondered about the extra time that Peter Klimovsky would have had to bed his methods in with his squad. Well, so far, obviously, that hasn't borne fruit in terms of results. They've lost all five games they've played so far and sit bottom of the table after five matches, obviously, as a result of that. But have you seen any real green shoots of growth that you like lead you to think that better days are not just around the corner, but coming up very shortly in their future?
I think it will still take a bit of time. I thought last week against Gamba they played a lot better than they did against Kobe. But their problem has been that they're playing wonderful stuff up until the area, but the final pass isn't very good, or as we saw in this game, the finishing is poor. Goto missed a really good chance, and against Gamba they missed quite a few chances. They could, on another day, have won that game if they had a bit of composure going forward. I think the problem that they have compared to Marinos in that first season is they're still going to have all the defensive issues and the playing it out from the back issues, but Marinos at least had quality in forward areas a little bit more so than Shimizu do. I don't think Tirashil, as good a player as he can be, I don't think he's clinical enough up front. If they say had Douglas still there, I think this could be a different Shimizu team and they might get a few more results early on, but at the moment they're just struggling to really put away chances. They've still got players that are coming back. El Senior had his first game from the start, and Renato Augusto as well is coming in, so maybe that once those players get back together they can have a bit more consistency in their team selection and it will help them out. But yeah, I thought Saturday was a step back. I thought defensively again they were poor. The goal for Douglas, the first one where kind of Huang seems to be ahead of Douglas and should just clear it, but then Omeida, the young goalkeeper, has come out halfway, so there's a bit of confusion there, and that led to the goal, and they're just totally open again. And I just think great for them that there's no relegation, because it's going to be a struggle this season, but it's going to be a real learning experience for that team, and hopefully for them, no matter how this season goes in terms of where they finish, they can learn from it and build on to next season.
At the risk of expanding this podcast into tomorrow, I'd like to butt in and say that I did see some good stuff, especially against Gamba last week, and even in the last 15 minutes or so this week from S-Pulse, and I like the way they're trying to play. I think the problem may be El Senior, Valdo, Renato Augusto coming back in. I think that possibly might be a problem for the team, because as there is no relegation, I think that they have to suck up the bad results. The fans have to suck up the bad results and be patient, like F. Marino's fans were. I think F. Marino's were bottom at the start of the season before they won the championship. They started off very badly because on the bench for S-Pulse this weekend, for example, was Tatsuta, Okazaki, Suzuki, Masaka, Nishizawa. Hideki Ishige is out injured. There's 6, 7, 8 very good young players who could be being blended into this team now instead of getting 10 minutes at the end of a game for the long-term future of the team. So the key is, does this team want to build for the long term? But will they, losing all these games, kill their confidence completely? There's a very good balancing act about to be coming, I think. And I get the feeling that I'd like to see more of the youngsters coming in earlier. But I get the feeling that it's going to be more of, okay, bring in the older heads and let's try and clean up the results a bit, which in the end will be not what this team needs. I think more youngsters, a few more losses, but learning how to play the game over the season. No relegation next year. Wow, that's me. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. As you said, it's the blend. I don't think it harms them too much to have one or two more experienced players to guide them through that, to keep their heads up when they do go a goal down and just keep them on the right path and playing the way the manager wants them to play. And I think El Senior, especially with all his J-League experience, is one of the players I'd like in my team just to help the youngsters out. But I agree with you, there are a lot of good youngsters at Shimizu who deserve a bit more of a chance. Nishizawa, especially, last season was very good, and he's being displaced at the moment. So I hope for him and the other players that you mentioned, they do get their chances, and I'm sure they will with the amount of fixtures that are about to be played.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, well, Klimovsky, this is his first chance as a manager in his own right. So, I mean, I'm sure he will be bringing players through where he sees fit. But, I mean, at the end of the day, for him, it's a results-based business. And, yes, there's no relegation this season, but he'll want to put the best product out on the park he can on a week-to-week basis. If that involves a number of young players in certain games here and there, then I'm sure he'll do that and make those decisions when they come up in front of him. But, yeah, I mean, he's going to want to see his team do the best they can, and he'll set them up as best he can to get the results that he hopes they can get. So far, certainly has not worked out for Klimovsky and his side, but, they have an opportunity on Wednesday night to start to turn things around. But, yeah, let's not take anything away from Kobe, a very professional victory, and, obviously it was never in doubt, really, after they went 2-0 up early in the second half, and yeah, Furuhashi finishing off his brace to certainly wrap up the 3 points. All right, well, Alan, that's terrific to get your thoughts on all three Kansai clubs, and indeed your answers to Johnny's questions. Thanks again for those, Johnny. So usually before we let you go, Alan, we get an update on what's happening with J Soccer Magazine, but this time you've added another string to your bow. Not only are you a magazine editor and publisher, you're also now a very fetching kit designer.
Isn't it lovely? My design skills are completely lacking, but thanks to a Twitter user called Elartanag, Elartanag. He lives in Argentina, and it's, of course, Spanish for the art of nag. You can look him up by Elartanag, Elartanag, or ask me and I'll let you know. But both him and I are publicizing the shirt on Twitter. He's done all the design work. I've just thrown a few ideas at him, but that's all these lovely summer shirts that the J-League team has always come up with are so popular and always so limited too, of course, and expensive. That I just thought, let's see if I can make a shirt. And I've really gone a bit over the top because we have the Japan three-legged crow in there, although I had to be careful that three legs are not visible because it's probably copyrighted. So we've got the crow. We've got the samurai helmet. We have Mount Fuji on the back. We have some sakura. We have, I'm not sure if the wave is in the back there. I can't really quite see it, but that famous wave from Japanese art. But we've really gone totally over the top and designed a shirt that really means Japan. And then kept the price down. Literally, it's going to be only $79 as opposed to $150 or $200 that the J-League teams usually give. And I've managed to sell off about 30 or 40 in advance already. So another 10 or 20, and it will be paid for. And the idea is that if I can get it paid for, then we'll make another one and another one. We'll have a whole series of them. Lots of people suggested doing a peace jersey or doing a Vivaran jersey or doing a Gamba jersey with certain parts of Osaka on, but obviously these things are copyrighted. So I've just gone totally over the top and gone all Japanese and thought of everything I could think of and thrown it all on a shirt. If you're on Twitter, please check out J League Shirts. Or the name is Japan Football Shirts, or find the usual thing, J Soccer Magazine, and ask me. It's on pre-order. The pre-order was only $50 for the first 10. They went very fast. $58 for the next 10. They have now gone, and it's $66 now for the next 20. And then it'll still only be, the top price will only be $79. Plus shipping around the world, of course. And we're limiting the print run to only 100, and I think it's going to be quite nice. So a bit of a business plug there, sorry about that. Well, I wouldn't say it's a business, it's probably another money losing venture in the end, but having great fun designing it, and people are really quite excited about it. So if you'd like to get in on that shirt, please check out those two accounts on Twitter at J League Shirts or J Soccer Magazine, and see if you can get yourself one. So thank you very much for the opportunity to publicize it, Ben.
Yeah, no worries at all. And I'd actually missed the first wave of social media posts that you put out last week, and yeah, I didn't notice until Friday, but yeah, it really is a lovely looking kit. If you haven't seen it yet, yeah, please head to at J League Shirts or at J Soccer Magazine on Twitter, and you'll be able to scroll down and find some tweets with pictures of the kit in the timelines. Very, very fetching looking kit, and yeah, very competitively priced, as Alan has already said, and yeah, some still available for cheaper than the base price. So, all right, well, yeah, we will leave it there. Thank you ever so much for your time again. Great evening for the Kansai clubs on Saturday night, and we'll catch up again soon, I'm sure.
Thank you for allowing me to talk for so long about the subject I love.
All right, then, after another quick hit of music, Sam and I will wrap up the rest of the J1 Match Day 5 slate. Next to the Wild and Woolly events at Mitsuzawa on Saturday night, where Yokohama FC hosted Kawasaki in a Kanagawa derby. There were early warning signs for Yokohama FC with their goalkeeper Yuta Minami twice called into action to save from Leandro Damião in the first 10 minutes. And Yasuto Wakizaka broke the deadlock just before the half hour when he volleyed home from just inside the penalty spot after Leandro's header had come back off the bar. It was not to be the Brazilian's night, but just before the hour, Yokohama FC restored parity when Yusuke Matsuo shot from the edge of the area and the ball struck Masakazu Tashiro on its way past Junsung Ryong. So Tashiro, the defender, was ultimately credited with the goal. And, Sam, I guess after Tashiro's goal went in, an hour played and Yokohama FC had worked their way back somehow to 1-1. They, whether they would have been optimistic they could go on and get a point or maybe snatch all three is up for debate, and we'll never know. But, I'm not sure they were prepared for a four-goal onslaught in the last 15 minutes from Frontale.
No, I think the final scoreline is very harsh on Yokohama. I thought they did really well to get back into it when they went 1-0 down, because for the first 20 minutes, half an hour, even maybe the first half, Kawasaki were well on top. As you mentioned, Minami made a couple of decent saves, and Yokohama had done well enough to escape with being 1-0 down. But after them, they really took the game to Kawasaki. I think they were building on the confidence that they've had from a few good results and performances in the last couple of weeks. And they were fully deserving of going 1-1 with Matsuo's goal. And it was just a couple of decisions and things that just went against Yokohama that kind of took the game away from them. I think at 1-1, it was very even, really. I think they were given as good as they've got, which sort of plays into Kawasaki's hands because they like teams to come onto them and give them a game and leave space for Kawasaki to attack into. But they were still a bit fortunate with the penalty that got them 2-1 up. I thought it was a pretty soft decision. There was very minimal contact on Mitoma as he was going through. But he was a good young player, actually, and really did change the game for Kawasaki with a bit more attacking impetus. And then Kobayashi, back from injury, stepped up from the spot, and then 2-1, Kawasaki were right in control. They got another penalty pretty quickly and then took the game away from Yokohama. But until that point, for the first 70 minutes, I thought Yokohama gave a really good account of themselves.
Yep, so I guess, yeah, they have impressed in stretches so far. And, at the end of the day, this looks like a tonking. But, as you say, Sam, they had done well to work their way back to parity. And, a fraction unlucky with a couple of decisions. And then, obviously it spiralled a little bit out of control in the last 10 minutes or so. But, I'm sure they'll dust themselves off. Well, they basically haven't got any choice because there's another game on Wednesday and then there's another game next Sunday. So, yeah, you obviously can't feel too sorry for yourself after a result like that. You've got to get back to work, and I'm sure they will do so as, there's a pretty huge game for them coming up on Wednesday night, a Yokohama derby, nonetheless. So, I'm sure they'll be trying to get back to their former selves on Wednesday night. But, yeah, Kawasaki obviously roll on. They remain atop of the pile. They've got their customary home draw against Tosu out of the way very, very early doors. And, since then, they've just gone on and swept all before them. But, well, there might be tougher tests than Yokohama FC ahead of them. We shall see. All right, well, yeah, so we've also obviously already covered FC Tokyo and Cerezo Osaka, who are currently sitting joint second. Let's move on to talk about Nagoya, who, well, I guess we probably shouldn't really be too surprised that they've moved up to fourth in the table, Sam, because they had made strong starts to the last couple of seasons, although I guess there were serious doubts over them heading into this campaign after the restart, after the Joe decided to jump ship. But they broke down a stubborn Tosu defence at home on Saturday night, thanks to the substitute Naoki Maeda. He'd come on just 6 minutes before his 62nd minute winner, and what a superb goal it was too. He swiveled to volley in Hiroyuki Abe's deft chip over the defence, and by the way, Maeda had already smashed a shot against the bar after coming on before he struck that winner. We've mentioned with Alan that the Tosu substitute Thiago Alves was shown a second yellow card after kicking out at Yutaka Yoshida late on. But Tosu, who of course came into this game still looking for their first goal of the season, did finally have the ball in the net in the 87th minute when Eduardo backheeled in from a yard out. But unfortunately for Sagan, he was offside when the ball came off the substitute Renzo Lopez following a corner. So the goal was correctly chalked off. And the Tosu goals scored column still says zero after five games, Sam. I guess it stayed 1-0 for as long as it did, the last half hour, Tosu, while they haven't scored yet, they were always, they will do at some point this season. So Nagoya will just be thankful that that goal was chalked out. And, they were not the first team to concede against Sagan this season.
Yeah, you don't want to be that team that Tosu are playing. But I thought they were a little bit better going forward, mainly restricted to long-range efforts, as they have been for most of the season. But, as you mentioned, the Eduardo chance that was offside. And also with the post, I think good save again from Langerak, who started this season superbly in goal for Nagoya, a key reason why they're defensively doing quite well. And Maeda came off the bench and had a bit more quality about him, and that's what Nagoya do have. I mean, we mentioned a lot about the way Ficadenti wants to play, but there are so many good players in that team, and if you've got a player like Maeda coming off the bench, he turned the game immediately. Just that extra impetus, hitting the crossbar pretty much straight away, and then, yeah, wonderful technique on the volley, and it was a goal worthy of winning any game. But for Tosu, again, where are the goals going to come from? They've now lost Thiago Alves to a suspension. He's probably been their best player, even though he didn't start in this game, which was a slightly interesting decision. Maybe saving him, that was the plan for midweek, but that plan has now gone awry. But realistically, I still don't see where the goals are coming from. Toyota not really looking like scoring. It maybe would have done 4 years ago. Renzo Lopez, I mean, he got involved towards the end, but he's not really looked like a great player. And Tosu just need to find a spark from somewhere, and then they kind of did that last season, eventually scoring through Cuenca, I believe it was last season, maybe 8 games in. So hopefully for them, they can get that spark. But at the moment, it just looks like nothing's really falling for them.
Yeah, they might come pretty close to matching that that record, right, of eight games with no goals. Yeah, we shall see. But yeah, for Nagoya, obviously another positive result. As we say, they move up to fourth in the table. All right, well, there's 3 games left to review, and there were goals aplenty in all three of them. I'll tell you what, Sam. Yeah, we'll move on to Sendai 2 Sapporo 2, because this game had literally everything. Terrific goals, a straight red card, and some late drama, a fight back, and a last minute equaliser. So Sendai went ahead in the 23rd minute when Rio German finished off a lightning quick counter attack that started right back inside their own box. And Sendai probably should have had a penalty just 4 minutes later when Shun Nagasawa's header clearly struck the arm of Sapporo captain Hiroki Miyazawa, but the referee waved play on. I won't stop to get Sam's thoughts on the fact that Shun Nagasawa was actually captain of Sendai for this particular game, and what that says what that says about Sendai. But anyway, yes, we move on. The referee was unmoved in that case, but he had no choice in the 32nd minute, as we mentioned with Alan, when Takuma Arano kicked out at Kunimitsu Sekiguchi after an aerial duel and was shown a straight red card. Sapporo still did pose a threat, though, after going down to 10 men. And, the Chanatip was obviously at the heart of a lot of things that they did well. Douglas Oliveira was in to make his first league start for the club, with Musashi Suzuki still out injured and Jay Bothroyd rested. But then after Takanori Sugino and Yuma Obata exchanged superb saves either side of halftime, Keiya Shihashi seemingly wrapped up the points for Sendai with a 25-yard screamer on the hour. But no, the 10 men of Sapporo fought back. And just 2 minutes later, it was Chanatip, of all people, who rose in the box, and his thunderous header from Lucas Fernandez's cross from deep on the right gave Consadole a lifeline. Sendai were unable to kill the game off, and Sapporo, therefore, were always a chance to snatch a point, and they managed it in the 91st minute when the substitute Bothroyd headed Fernandez's corner down onto the leg of fellow sub Shunta Tanaka, with the ball dribbling over the line as Obata scrambled across his line, but tellingly a yard inside his goal. For some reason, he'd retreated behind the goal line, and even if he had got across to save it, he wouldn't have mattered, because he was well and truly inside the goal. But Sam, this game had absolutely everything, and I guess you've got to give Sapporo a golf clap for fighting back from 2-0 down and down to 10 men to rescue a point at the death is absolutely terrific. At the same time, though, Sendai will have been absolutely gutted not to take all 3 points from this.
Yeah, full credit to Sapporo. They showed another more fighting quality. Everything was going against them at the start of the game. They missed chances. Chanatip was fantastic again, just his driving runs from midfield. But Douglas Oliveira just... Maybe he's not quite up to speed to it, but the two chances he missed, he really should have scored, and you'd back Musashi Suzuki to have put them away when he was playing. But Sendai, for large parts, were in control. They, as they should have been against 10 men, they really should have put the game to bed, and they'll be very frustrated that they've not come away with the 3 points. But Sapporo have enough quality in that team. We've got Chanatip channeling his inner Tim Cahill with his header. Don't ever expect any defence would have expected to concede to a Chanatip header, but it was a really well taken header from a good cross. And then Sapporo got a bit of fortune with the winner, with the equaliser, but they probably deserved it for the way they played. And they're now allowed to go back home. They've got a run of home games coming up, so they've done well to get the amount of points they have done from their away games to start this resumption. And hopefully they can build on that and take some form into their home games and, start really moving and challenging for the ACL places, which is what Sapporo will want to do. And for Sendai, just frustrating. I'm not going to go into Nagasawa, but I think because Nishimura was on the bench again, and surely he has to play. If you want to play your best team, him and Guedes are the two really good attacking players that they have in their team. Once you bring Cuenca back, that's a really good front three. So I just think not using them, it doesn't play Sendai to their fullest potential. It's a bit negative. So maybe he might make a change going forward, but they just missed a couple too many chances in this game to put it to bed. But I think credit to Sapporo.
Yeah, most definitely. And you've touched on it there. I was just going to ask you how much credit they deserve for, sitting seventh after five games is certainly not pulling up any trees. But when you consider the fact that, since the restart, they've been away from home every single game. And as you say, they finally get to go home on Wednesday night when they host FC Tokyo. So, I concur. And, the fighting spirit they showed here, the last... away game of this this road trip to start the season. To fight back a man down and two goals down to rescue a point is, very, very creditable performance. And, I'm not sure if you know the extent of Suzuki's injury, Sam, whether he is expected back soon or not. But, yeah, there definitely was a noticeable difference with Douglas Oliveira not quite up to speed. And obviously Bothroyd not there from the start. That's a couple of very important cogs out of the Sapporo attack missing from the start.
Yeah, they're keeping it kind of close to their chest of the exact severity of Suzuki's injury. But one thing that will help them is Anderson Lopez is not too far away from being allowed to play again. He has flown back to Japan, but they have to go through the 2 weeks of quarantine and whatnot. So hopefully by the start of August, he's back. It gives them an extra cog up front, and definitely they can then rotate between Bothroyd and Anderson Lopez if Suzuki is out. All the three of them can interchange as well, so that will really help them as well. So I think they've done really well to get through a challenging period at the start of this resumption, and I think they're well placed to go back home and hopefully build on that.
Well, hopefully not. After Wednesday night, if they don't.
Of course, of course.
yes. But very, very timely that Anderson Lopez is back as they return to Sapporo Dome. He can go back to jumping in the moat there after scoring goals for Consadole. Yes, indeed. All right. Well, yeah. The last two games we have left to review were absolute goal fests. And, if you said at the start of the season that we'd be saving Kashima versus Yokohama F. Marinos to the eighth game of nine that we'd have to review in a match day, I'd have said you were speaking absolute nonsense. But, of course, heading into this game, Antlers were rock bottom with nil pois after four games, and Yokohama F. Marinos were stuck down towards the end of the table as well in the bottom six after four games. And, these two teams served up a goal fest, Sam, a brace for ISA Wada for Antlers, a brace for Marcos Junior for Yokohama F. Marinos. But, Antlers were able to do more elsewhere to ultimately run out 4-2 winners in the very definition of a wild and woolly encounter.
Yeah, they'll be devastated. They've managed to get eighth with this game. It was a fantastic game for the neutral, not necessarily if you're a fan of Yokohama, because they kind of retreated back to 2018 Yokohama, especially second half when Thiago Martins went off. Their back line was completely all over the place. The fourth goal was just summed up Yokohama from a couple of years ago, where a mistake at the back and the goalkeeper is chipped from 40 yards. It was just, we saw that week in, week out, really, a couple of years ago, and it's creeping in a little bit the way that Yokohama have started this season. That, I think it's just the lack of kind of consistency that they have in their back line, because Thiago Martins has been injured he's missed a couple of the games so far, and they've changed right back a couple of times, so it's not really been settled, and they were caught out time and time again, second half especially, just woeful defending. But I'm going to give credit to Kashima. They've not started this season well at all, but the manager has been tinkering a lot. He's been trying to get things right, and this time he gave away to the start up front with Yasushi Endo brought back in behind him, and they moved Everaldo, who started most games up front, they moved him left wing, which is an interesting call because he's mainly a centre forward, but I mean, he showed he could play left wing with his crossing for the first goal. It's a terrific ball in for Ueda. And Alano also got his assist later on in the game for Everaldo. So those gambles worked for Kashima. It gave them a boost. It's got them off the bottom of the league. But then the questions are all now on Yokohama, who've started the season, at least from results-wise, quite poorly. There were signs going forward in this game that they were back towards their best. I think the first Marcos Junior goal, although it should have been given offside against Nakagawa, was a way that those four players up front that we mentioned a couple of weeks ago that didn't really link up well against Shonan. But in this game, especially for this goal, the link-up play was superb. It was like vintage Yokohama and the exact way that they want to play the game and get goals. And terrific goal, but as well as they play going forward, just they can't be so open defensively, and it's going to cost them, and it has done in a few games already this season.
Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, there were some terrific goals on display here. Wada, he's obviously just coming through, and a lot of pressure on the young player's shoulders coming into a team like Kashima, and obviously we've seen his performances for the national team where his finishing hasn't been particularly up to scratch. I mean, it was great for him to get that very, very early goal in just the fourth minute to set Antlers on their way. But, I mean, you could see with the chances that he missed before half-time, Sam, that he's far from the finished article. But do you think he could possibly become the next top-draw Antlers striker? Do you think he's got that in him to really burst through like that? Or, I mean, while there are still so many doubts about his finishing, I mean, it's obviously very, very early to make a call like that. But have you seen enough from him so far?
I think the raw ability is definitely there. It's just maybe the mental side of the game, which a lot of Japanese strikers, I don't want to be too stereotypical about it, but there's the lacking of the quality up front and the composure in front of goal, which was definitely his problem with the Copa America. But, I mean, he was a young kid just thrown out of university into the national team, so that's perfectly understandable. And he's not really played too many games for Kashima in the J-League either, and he was given the responsibility in this game to be the focal man up front. And while he took his first goal well, and indeed the second goal he scored, there are still those holes going forward and just in front of goal. But if he gets a run of games and a little bit of confidence from the manager behind him, then I think there's definitely the ability in the player to go on and become a very good striker. There has to be for a manager to have picked him for the national team straight out of university. There's definitely something there. It just needs to be harnessed and refined a little bit, but definitely he's one to watch for this season if Kashima are to go with him and, you know, give him more game time, because we don't really know how this manager's going to settle on a team. It's been complete chop and change. I don't think you'll be too happy with your boy Sean Adoy being left out of the starting 11 for the last three games. But if this works for Kashima, then it'd be great for Ueda. And yeah, they really do need to find a striker that's going to score regular goals.
Yes, well, not sure about this Zago fella, but anyway, hopefully you'll see sense. And yeah, our boy Sharma will be back and the starting 11 in due course. But yeah, I mean, with Wedo, I mean, you could clearly see that by the time he missed that second clear chance before half time, that things seemed to be weighing on him. So the fact that he didn't really need to think about his second goal when he basically slid in to steer home Rikito Hirose's ball in from the right. I mean, that's the sort of chance that he needed probably that sort of at that time of the game, I think, where, yeah, he didn't really have time to think. He just had to react to the ball in front of him and, yeah, steered it home. And that was obviously the goal that got Antlers back in front, and there was still so much more to happen in the game. Everaldo made it 3-1 before Marcos Junior got his second of the game with a sublime curler from the edge of the box with 20 minutes left. So that was still Antlers with a one-goal advantage, 3-2 up. But, yeah, that the fourth Antlers goal is, as you say, it's just vintage F. Marino's defending, isn't it? Yeah, a very loose ball straight across the back line from Shinosuke Hatanaka, and Ryohei Shirasaki has, first time chipped the keeper from, basically 35, 40 yards out. To wrap up the scoring in the 82nd minute. So, what a game at Kashima Soccer Stadium, and what a way for Antlers to open their account in the 2020 J1 season. Yokohama F. Marino certainly have some thinking to do in the coming days with a Yokohama derby against Yokohama FC coming up at the Nissan Stadium on Wednesday night. They've got a bit of thinking to do, but yeah, in a derby, cliche. All right, and the final game, Sam, is arguably one of the most entertaining of the match day at Hitachi Dai. It finished Kashiwa 3, Shonan 2. A brace for Michael Olunga in the first half, but again, Shonan yet to win this season, and they've come close on numerous occasions. In time, they're just going to get sick of us saying they've put in a good performance, but have got nothing to show from it. But again, they fought back well here after going 2-0 down, but ultimately they've left Hitachi Dai with nothing.
Yeah, this is their third 3-2 defeat, if I remember correctly, which, I mean, it's quite staggering, really, to score two goals against such quality opposition as they have done in Reds, Kashiwa and Yokohama, and come away with nothing both times. they still missed chances in this game that they really should have taken. They Ibuski was there. He brought on as a substitute. Just a dreadful footballer. I do apologise to him. But, yeah, it was one where the ball was played to him. And, I mean, he just couldn't sort his feet out. Didn't brain didn't react very quickly. And he just missed the ball as it went past him. But, yeah, that's just where they fell down. They haven't really got like a clinical striker. Ishihara has been playing. Tariq El-Yunusi has not really settled in at the moment. I mean, it's going to be difficult for him as the only current foreign player in a full-on Japanese team. I don't really. It'd be interesting to see how they're trying to integrate him into the squad, because it doesn't look like he's got an understanding with his teammates on the pitch at the moment. And then, otherwise, they just crumble a little bit defensively. I thought Kashua, who have started this resumption terribly, like making a mockery of pre-season predictions from me, but they changed it up a little bit. I thought Kamiya came in and Nakama came in and both looked really lively and took their opportunity as well. I thought Nakama's volley, especially for the third goal, was very nicely taken, and I think it was Kamiya's crossing for Olunga for the first goal, which is, yeah, another really good piece of play. But as is going to be their case for most of the season, Kashua are going to be very good going forward. Defensively, a bit error-prone. They brought in Kosuke Nakamura back in goal. And, you know, I don't like to say many bad things about Kosuke Nakamura, but I thought for the first goal, he made a save, but it was one that he does a little bit too often for my liking, which is quite a camera save, where he just flings himself and makes it look as impressive as possible. But this time, he just pushed it straight onto the head of Matsuda, who was following in. So, and maybe you could have criticised him for the second goal as well, though that would be a little harsh. But yeah, there are still issues at Kashua, but hopefully going forward, they seem to have at least found a couple of good players that will cause problems, and they will do throughout the season. It's just a case of how many games are they going to win 3-2, or how many is it going to be 2-3 the opposite direction. But and then Shonan, yeah, just they'll be really frustrated with how the season started, because they will feel they've been in a lot of games and deserve a lot more than the solitary point that they have got. But yeah, if you're not keeping things out and a bit tighter at the back, and conceding three goals regularly, then you're not going to win many games of football.
Yeah, most definitely. So, yeah, it was a first up brace for Michael Olunga, as I mentioned, a header in the 19th minute and then a penalty 1 minute before half time. I mean, Kashua probably should have had a penalty just before the half hour, but anyway, we've mentioned referees a few times already in this episode, so we'll move on. As Sam's mentioned, yeah, Kosuke Nakamura, the Hollywood save, but only straight onto the noggin of Tema Matsuda, who halved Shonan's deficit just past the hour. Hayato Nakama scored a brilliant goal 20 minutes from time, his first J1 goal to restore Raisel's two-goal cushion. But, Naoki Ishihara made it 3-2 with 7 minutes to go and set up a tense finish. But ultimately, Raisel emerged victorious and, yes, arrested their very, very ordinary run of form of three straight defeats since the restart. So, Sam, that leads us on to a question from Gabriel Anello about Raisel, and we have mentioned them, obviously, in the past couple of weeks where their results have gone against them. Gab asks, have we overrated Kashua Raisel? In his eyes, they might still be a dark horse for the top four, but the last performances haven't been exactly encouraging. I should say to you, though, Sam, and the listeners as well, that Gab sent this through last Friday after I put the feelers out on Patreon for questions. So Gab might be feeling a little bit better about Raisel after a Saturday night's result. But, there's no question that since the restart, Sam, they had been in very, very ordinary form. And despite this win, I mean, there's still obviously holes that they'll need to fix going forward.
Yeah, I don't think this result really papers over the cracks too much. They played okay, and they were a little bit better going forward, but the mistakes at the back are still there, and they still look like they could be overrun by a better team than Shonan. But I mean, it is too early to overreact and say we've overestimated them. I certainly hope so for my JPred prediction. But you've got the likes of Yokohama down there, who are 2 points worse off, and I don't think anyone at the moment is saying they're completely out of it and they've just turned into a terrible team overnight. So I think Kashua once they get... I still think Cristiano is so key to the way they play and just the how he galvanises that team. So I want to wait, really, for Cristiano to be back in that team before I can settle on and say this is the Kashua that we're going to see this season. But there are certainly a lot of gaps defensively that haven't really been focused upon by Nelsinho. I think they were still there in J2 and haven't really been improved upon. And maybe... I and maybe others could be guilty of maybe overlooking how bad their defensive deficiencies are, but I still think there is enough going forward and, generally speaking, enough in goal, whether it's Nakamura or Kim Sung-gyu, to kind of bail out that defence more often than not. So I still think there are decent chances for top four, and I wouldn't be ruling them out or saying we've over-egged them quite yet.
No, fair enough. Understandable. You're still fighting Raisel's corner. I understand. And just briefly before we leave Kashua, Richardson yellow card watch. That's two straight games without a booking for the bustling Brazilian after his return from suspension following his red card against FC Tokyo. All right, so we've covered the first half of Gab's question, Sam. Obviously, we're long finished talking about Sagan Tosu and their Saturday night loss against Nagoya. But the second part of Gab's question does refer to Sagan, and he asks, are Sagan Tosu on the run for the worst season ever, despite no relegation rule is in place? So, no goals after five games, but they've got previous in that regard, of course, Sam. And, at the moment, Sagan can point to two teams worse off than them in the forms of Shonan, who sits 17th, and Shimizu 18th with a nil pois after five games. But, in terms of goals scored, definitely they might be able to nudge their record of a few seasons ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to think they'd be the worst team. Tokushima, I think, are the worst team that I can remember. That was like 13 points or something during the season. I mean, you have to be a terrible team if you're going to be amassing that amount of points. And they've already got two. So I think they will... I don't think they're that bad. Defensively, I think they're solid enough that they'll grind out a few points and eventually they will start grinding out victories. I think they're a pretty poor team. They're probably the worst that I've covered in J1, and that's been the last 5 years or so. So I came in just after Tokushima's season. And I think they might just get a bit worse in the transfer window if financially they have to get rid of a few more players, as they did with Kanazaki earlier. So, I don't think it's going to be a very good season at all for Sagan Tosu, and I think I'm still fairly confident that they will finish bottom. But I think they'll squeak enough points to not be considered the absolute worst.
Yeah, okay then. All right, well, thanks, Gabriel, for your question. Indeed, thanks as well to Johnny Nicol and Thomas Bennington for their questions earlier on in the episode. All right, well, that's, J1 Match Day 5 reviewed. But, listeners, the games come thick and fast, as you know. And this Wednesday sees Match Day 6 played with the two unbeaten sides on the road. Leaders Kawasaki head up to Sendai, with Nagoya travelling down to Oita. As we've mentioned, Sapporo finally gets to enjoy some home comforts when they play their first game of the season at Sapporo Dome. FC Tokyo are their visitors. And, as we've also mentioned in the run of the podcast, two derbies on the slate. F Marinos host FC in the Yokohama Derby. And, you probably wouldn't have guessed at the start of the season that Yokohama FC would be ahead of F Marinos in the table when this fixture rolled around. There's also some Kansai bragging rights up for grabs when Cerezo Osaka host Kobe. Then in Sunday's Match Day 7, the last regional round before the league opens up at the start of August, Kawasaki host another Kanagawa derby, this time against Shonan. Kobe will hope to do an Osaka double when they host Gumba Osaka, and Sapporo are at home again with defending champions Yokohama F Marinos, their visitors. All right, Sam, well, we've managed to work our way through another episode. Great to hear from Dan and Alan throughout it all, of course. And, we're not making any promises to do any midweek stuff like John and Stuart did with the extra time, extra episodes last week, are we? But, we'll at least be back next Monday. We can promise the listeners that.
Yeah, we'll definitely be back as long as I've survived my first really early kickoff from them. The resumption, I think it's a 5:05 kickoff between Sapporo and Yokohama on Sunday, so I'm not particularly looking forward to that early start, but as long as I'm awake, I'll be back next Monday to record.
Terrific stuff. All right, well, that is it then for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. We'd like to thank Dan Orlowitz and Alan Gibson for guesting on the pod, and of course we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up match day 6 and 7 of the J1 season. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast.